Animal research gives experimenters a paycheck, but it doesn't give us cures for human illnesses. Using animals is costly, it's cruel, inefficient, and it's old-fashioned. Sophisticated non-animal research methods using whole human DNA, for example, is where our money should go. Help us insist on modern research. Rate People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's PETA, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Indeed. Keep that in mind. Animal research is not your friend. Anyway, Co-op Radio is your friend, and this is Co-op Radio. It's just 12 o'clock noon, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and around the world on cooperadio.org. And it is time now for the Animal Voices show. Animals are our friends, and here they come.
Welcome to Animal Voices. In this program, Animal Voices, we are dedicated to rekindling the spirit of care and respect for all life. No animal deserves to be mistreated or abused. Our laws are a reflection of our society's values, and our culture does not condone the torture of small, innocent animals. It's not a matter of choice. All over the world, loving people are challenging the blatant injustices towards animals, especially factory farming of animals. Factory farming of animals is a blatant injustice towards innocent cows, chickens, pigs, ducks, and turkeys. In many of our Animal Voices programs, we offer a glimpse into a world that has systematically been hidden from public view. Howard Lyman, in his book, No More Bull, he wrote, "All people, including school-aged children, should see what a slaughterhouse looks like so that they can know what they are eating. If they want to continue eating meat, let them make an informed choice." Howard Lyman. Anyway, Animal Voices comes to you by way of Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, which is a non-commercial, cooperatively owned, listener-sponsored, and supported community radio station. We're located in the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side. Co-op Radio is a voice for the voiceless and strives to provide space for underrepresented and marginalized community. Alan Jensen, thank you for being our technician. My name is Carl Loskin. And in today's program, shortly, we'll be speaking with Don Lynch, who will be calling from Puerto Vallarta in Mexico. And he believes that our society is living in a culture of fear. And he wonders whether eating animals raised in an unnatural environment of fear and frustration has anything to do with it. Co-host Marge Adams. Marge, what will you be doing today?
Well, there's a bylaw in the city of Vancouver that bans residents of the city from keeping chickens in their backyard. And at the present time, there are some people, many people, in fact, in the city who would like to have the privilege of keeping chickens, raising them in the city. And I'm going to be talking to Peter Fricker of the Vancouver Humane Society about the possibilities of having chickens and the implications of what this would mean to the city.
Well, you know, before the program, I was talking with Alan, and it was indeed a momentous occasion this past week where there was a change of administration, and maybe we will call back later. I believe our guest is online here. So we will be discussing later in this program some of the implications of a change of administration in Washington D.C. Well, Don Lynch, he spent most of his adult life in Iowa, in the United States, in the midst of the Corn Belt and pork capital of the world, where he observed animals living in fear and frustration in unnatural factory farm conditions. He now lives in the, in many ways, idyllic oceanside resort of Puerto Vallarta, and he's also interested in mind and body maximum performance. Welcome to Animal Voices, Don.
Thank you, Carlos.
Well, thank you. I love the name Carlos. it includes both my first name and my last name, parts of it. Anyway, well, it was an absolute joy meeting you there. And because, you know, you came firsthand, you lived in Iowa, and you said many meaningful things to me while we were sipping coffee at D's. And one of the things that you really implanted in my mind is that you said once, we live in a culture of fear and frustration. So what do you mean by that? And maybe you can enlarge on that.
Well, what I meant by that is that, you know, I travel back and forth every once in a while in the United States, and there's a definite difference between there and here. There, I notice there's a certain tension in the air everywhere you go, and everything you hear and see is all related to fear and frustration. And it's inevitable that we become, you know, what we're surrounded by, and that's what I see there.
Now, we're not hearing you very clearly. May I just ask if you're calling from a cell phone?
No, actually, I'm calling from a wireless phone, but let's see. Let me change location, sir.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's much better. Thanks for improving that. Anyway,
okay.
So maybe just tell us again about this culture of fear. And we're consuming. You lived in Iowa, which was the pork capital of the world, you said. So these animals are living in some kind of the fear. Does it affect people?
Well, we are what we eat, you know. And if we're surrounded by fear, and we're eating when we're fearful, I mean, it's become an intrinsic part of us, whether we want it or not.
So now, when you saw in Iowa this, pig farms, I mean, maybe just give us something of what you saw, because you didn't grow up in what you called the ivory towers of downtown New York or Los Angeles. You were a guy who shoveled it from time to time.
That's right. Even the farmers, what they used to be called farmers, but now they're called pork producers. The old-time farmers, you know, they knew that that pigs were healthier and happier and more disease-free when they lived in open areas. They had grass under their feet. The old-timers knew that. And the new guys, the pork producers in factory farming, they compensate for that change with the intensive production that they have, where they'll have thousands of hogs just in a very, very limited area. They compensate by a lot of drugs and a very closely analyzed diet, very closely analyzed and studied environment. But the net result is that these animals are living a life of frustration and fear, and it becomes a part of them. And when we consume the flesh of these animals, we are consuming everything that comes along with it.
Now,
and fear and frustration is part of it.
Now you said that they treat their animals well, with everything that they need for fast growth and stuff, but they themselves, these farmers, they're not aware of what the nutritional requirements of the human body is all about.
Yeah, it was very ironic. I've always been somewhat health orientated, and these farmers knew about taking care of pigs, feeding them right for maximum production. They knew more about that nutrition than they did about their own. It was a very ironic situation.
Now, Don, everything, I personally believe this, is that everything emits a different kind of vibration. Trees do, animals do, even different colors emit a different type of vibration. So it's, you know, like, that's why I find it so plausible what you say. We have to be really careful that if we eat consuming foods which have been grown in a vibration of terror and frustration, that this is going to be what we are. As you said, we are what we eat. And maybe you can tell us, do you ascribe to this vibration theory?
Well, that's a certainly leading question. As you know, frequencies is... I like to experiment with the use of frequencies to alleviate pain, to alleviate things within the human experience, okay? And, you know, to some extent I've experimented with animals too. But what I've learned is that, you know, of course, we have frequencies in us and around us every day. We are just a bag of water with a bunch of frequencies bouncing around in us. And frequencies around us. And if you're in a room of crowded people that are under a lot of pressure and frustration, you become part of that crowd.
Right.
And you assimilate the things around you all the time, whether you want to or not. And the same holds true with these animals that are factory farmed in conditions that are unnatural and unhealthy. And if we end up consuming their flesh, we're consuming those frequencies.
So, but you've dedicated yourself in many ways to improving people's minds and maximum performance, making them do things which they normally wouldn't do. And I was testimony to that. Maybe what brought you into that?
Well, what brought me into it was just a natural curiosity that I have. I like experimenting, and I have a background in experimental things with chiropractic. Been doing it off and on for about 30 years, sort of as a hobby, and have kind of stumbled upon the aspect of that I apply for professional mixed martial arts fighters to alleviate pain, take away fears of injury, things of that nature. And, you know, I don't make somebody do something they wouldn't do naturally. I just help eliminate the blockages that they have to maximize performance.
Now, I was witness to my twin brother, who was also in Puerto Vallarta with you, and you made him do something quite incredible just by tapping on his forehead. And maybe you can you have a wonderful healing art here, and that's why I revere your words so much, that you have related that also to animals. But do you remember that my twin brother saying to you he had never touched his toes for 25 or 30 years? In fact,
yes.
He couldn't reach his arms further down than just a little bit below his knees. And then tell me what you did and what is the principle involved here, and what can we learn from that?
Well, the principle involved is that we're just a bag of frequency, or a bag of water, and we're just got frequencies bouncing around in us. All I did with him was he focused on that feeling that he had. I don't remember if it was a particular spot on his body or in his back or his legs or whatever, but you focus on that point. And then I don't know if you remember, but I also put my hand on his neck and touched pressure points on his face. And what I did was create an electrical circuit, and the energy that he was focused on, I put back into him. And that broke that due to mechanical resonance. It breaks up, since it's the exact same frequency that he's focused on, it breaks it up and becomes other frequencies, and that's how it works. It broke apart whatever energy it was that was trapped, that was limiting his range of motion.
Now, you know, he has the skepticism of a scientist, since he's a surgeon, and he touched his toes while you were tapping on his forehead. He couldn't believe his eyes what he was able to do. I mean, it's mind-boggling. I mean, it was like the unbelievable happening here.
Well, the most ironic part of this, Carlos, is that everybody has this ability.
Right. So
everybody.
So maybe Marge has a question for you.
I'm interested in knowing or in learning from you how this is done. Can you explain it to a person who's completely ignorant?
Well, I'm sure you're not completely ignorant. But what it is, it's just a basic law of physics that two exact frequencies, when they collide, they break up and become other frequencies. Mm-hmm. And it's the same basis that homeopathic medicine is based on. Homeopathic medicine has been around for centuries, and it's based on the same thing. If you have a cold, they give you a cold back into you. You have to identify the cold exactly, the symptoms of the cold, and they take that formula and they give it to you, and your cold goes away. It's the same exact thing.
It breaks
all
up
I'm doing is I did a shortcut.
Oh.
Hmm. Your skin is monopolar electric. So if I hook up to you or you hook up to somebody else, you can work with that person on whatever they're feeling at the time, be it an emotion, a negative emotion, or pain, or whatever you got.
Goodness sakes, you could put the medical producers, the pharmaceuticals, out of business if you could teach people this.
Well, really, it's like an extension of existing research, really. There's people out there already that are doing research for the future. In the future, medicine will be transmitted via internet, and you'll listen to frequencies on your headphones, and you can get medicine that way. That's the way medicines work. Hmm. They are vibrating at a certain frequency, and they affect your bacteria, your virus, or whatever, and it breaks it up. That's how frequencies work.
I see. Amazing. Thank you.
Now, people have many obstacles that in their thinking as well. And, well, you did an experiment with me in alleviating some of my confines of thought. So that can extend to even that, because I thought that when the following day you asked me what I was thinking, I said, well, I had alleviated some entrenched anger, and even though I would want to deny that I do have anger, I still feel... I did have resentments, and maybe I'm being just using words here, but that also worked as far as doing things over the phone where you could be a healer. I mean,
well, actually, you know, my healing rate over the phone is about 85%.
Right. Mm.
But dealing with emotions is actually, it can be a very profound thing, it's not something that's simple.
Right.
If I'm dealing with people everybody's different. Some people, it's just what they call a one-minute miracle, you know. But other people, it can take a long time because they carry around a lot of stuff with them. But it's amazing, you know. Well, you saw one example that I did right there in the coffee shop. I do it for free coffee every once in a while down there. You know.
Now, I had a wonderful experience, and I'm going to ask you about national frequencies, because when I went from India to Nepal, and the minute I looked at the person who looked at my passport, I instantly felt that I was in a different country. I mean, and looked at the other people. It was like a very Buddhist, and it was an unforgettable experience. But we're evolving all the time. And this past week was maybe for us here in Co-op Radio, very significant time, because maybe we do live in a time where we hope that that times and the temperament and the vibrations that you talk about and the frequencies will change towards reconciliation rather than aggression and power that overwhelms people who don't think the same as us do. How was it for you, Don?
Carlos, you want a free, happy world?
Yes.
Bam, you got it right now. Creature world every day.
You okay? Know, you know, Don, you're a gift. You are a gift? Do you feel you are a gift to humanity?
No, not really, but I'm just doing, you know, I'm just going with the flow here. I want to see how far we can take this, and I hope if just one person listens to this, that maybe it'll open their mind up and realize, yes, really, we create our own world every day.
You know,
and the way we feel individually affects everybody around us.
You know, Don, I was listening to you, and you made it a better world for me. I thank you for being on Animal Voices and imparting your message of good, a good-hearted message.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Okay, and we've been speaking with Don Lynch, who lives in Puerto Vallarta, and if you had to go to Dee's in the old part of the city, Dee's Coffee Shop, around about noon, you're likely to meet Don, and he's very willing to share his wealth of information to everybody who comes there. And okay, so I wonder if Alan, we could just have a little spot of music.
Okay, just a little bit of a nice piece by Brian McNeil called "A Cold Frosty Morning." It somehow seems suitable. Cold, frosty morning. It's nice to see the sun, though. It is a cold, frosty morning today, but it was nice and bright here. And I think, to some degree, after the events in the States this last week, everybody in the world is thinking it's a somewhat brighter, sunnier world.
Yes, it is indeed, even though it's going to reach a high of 2 degrees above zero in Vancouver today. Well, many Canadians were glued to their TV sets to watch Mr. President, no longer President-elect, but the President of the United States, Obama, where he urged the people of North America to choose our better history, to reject a false choice between safety and American ideals, and to recognize that American military power does not entitle us to do as we please. He was clearly signaling a commitment to remake the United States' approach to the world and to embrace pragmatism not just as a government strategy, but also as a basic value. So, also heralded together with that was the new administration, which is going to look more kindly on many environmental aspects. And I know, Alan, maybe you can just say a little bit about what it meant to you to watch that speech from the being broadcast all over the world to almost maybe a billion people.
It was such a contrast and such a change in more than one way, because it was the end of the old administration, and the whole planet has been living in this horror show for the last 8 years since George Bush and his people took over the states and imposed on their own country and on the rest of the world all sorts of terrible measures, terrible things going down politically and environmentally as well. They haven't left the world in a good place after 8 years. And Obama brings promise in many respects, clearly to the people of the United States, particularly the African-American population, which is just still, I think, you know, living in disbelief that an African-American could become president of the states. After it was just so recently that the civil rights fights were going on and you know, Jim Crow was still alive, and all of a sudden this has happened. But Obama, certainly for many people all over the world, represents possibilities of a new and more thoughtful United States, somebody with some intelligence being in the White House and making changes. And in terms of what we do in this program, I think George Bush has completely disregarded the environment and ecological issues, and the Obama administration is bound to pay more attention to that.
Yes, and last week Barack Obama officially unveiled a big economic stimulus proposal that includes a number of green measures. It calls for doubling of alternative energy over the next 3 years, and for 25% of electricity in the United States to come from renewable resources by the year 2025. It also includes a goal of retrofitting more than 75% of federal buildings and 2 million homes to make them more energy efficient. So also the other stimulus was that it's been suggested to him that he also invest in a new food system, and that this food system should be part of the economic spending package. And the people that are manning the environmental are no longer the spokespeople, the environmental key positions in Washington, D.C., are no longer the spokesperson people for corporations. And in fact, Obama, he picked one of Hilda Solis from Democrat. She's expected to be a very strong advocate for green jobs. So in this time of economic crisis, we'll be heading maybe in a tack which is away from total eyes on military spending.
Hey, what's her position?
She's in labor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I was wondering, I don't know who his Minister of the Interior is, and I was wondering who he'd chosen for that. I haven't heard. But just apropos of what you were saying, politicians, of course, respond to their constituencies, to the people who support them and put them in office. And Obama has the labor and the African American population who as his biggest single blocks of supporters, and those are his constituency, and those are the people he's going to have to respond to, as opposed to, as you were saying, the people who were the big constituencies behind George Bush, which was the Christian fundamentalists, the right-wing Republicans, and the big corporations. This is quite a different set of forces that are going to be pushing Obama in various directions. And it's just going to be really interesting to see. Obviously, he can't just move in and make, you know, huge changes overnight, because there is still a lot of inertia carried by the conservatives in the states, and it's not, you know, you can't just change things overnight, and as regardless of what he wants to do, and we'll just see how things unfold, but certainly It's looking positive, and it's going to be interesting to see some particular issues, because George Bush was ready to move on the north slope of Alaska and open all that to oil exploration. It's going to be interesting to see how Obama responds to that and other similar issues that are hugely important to wildlife. In terms of the what our program is about, Animal Voices, how the decisions he makes are going to impact on both domestic and wild animals.
Yeah, and in during these times where global climate change is affecting us, there was a report that came out from University of Washington that said that half the world's populations could be facing food shortages and due to climate change, and the stresses on global food production from temperature alone is going to be huge. And that doesn't take into account that water supplies are going to be stressed by these higher temperatures. And in today's Vancouver Sun, we had there's an article about somebody who did article here on the North Shore. It said trees are dying faster than 17 years ago. This was a UBC professor who said that she's seen the rate doubling in the last 17 years. Well, Marge, over to you. And you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Many of our programs will be posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org.
Thank you, Carl. As I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, the City of Vancouver has a bylaw which bans residents of the city from keeping backyard chickens. Now, last summer, the City Council received a request that the bylaw be amended. Since that time, the Food Policy Council has researched the possibility, and the group is expected to be soon to be presenting their recommendations to the Council. And there's a lot of controversy over this and amongst the public. Some are for the idea of having backyard chickens, and some, for various reasons, are against them. Today we're going to have Peter Fricker, who is the coordinator of projects for the Vancouver Humane Society, and we're going to talk about the urban chicken issue. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Marge.
Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Now, Peter, the bylaw has been on the books for over 30 years, and I would like you to tell us why, at this point in history, the issue has come to a head, really, at the City Council.
Well, I think it's because across North America there has been this trend amongst people who would like to see backyard poultry allowed in cities, and it's really stemmed from the whole sort of local food, environmental issues, food security, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we certainly understand that. We can appreciate the very positive aspects that people have seen in the idea of keeping a few chickens in your backyard, including the environmental benefits, food security, as I mentioned, and so on. However, we have looked at it, looked into this from an animal welfare point of view, and we do have a number of concerns.
Mm-hmm, yes, I can imagine. Probably a lot of people might impulsively go out and buy a couple of chickens, especially for the eggs, perhaps. But there are other things. Let's just think about the positive of having chickens for a moment.
Sure.
As you said, it would increase the local food supply. And chickens would be fairly good neighbors, I think, because they're reasonably quiet, unless you, of course, have a morning rooster crowing. But that probably would not be allowed. They do clean up the yard of slugs. They befriend the gardeners. They provide fertilizer, of course, for the compost. So that would be a plus. And they do, of course, produce eggs, which a lot of people would want. Unhappily, though, they probably would not keep them on after they completed their egg-laying cycle, which is, I've read, 3 years approximately. so that those are kind of the positives. But now you started telling us about the view of, for the animals themselves, and I think that's extremely important.
That's correct, and as I say, we do recognize those benefits, and I have to say this has been a very tricky and complicated issue for us because we can see both sides. But in purely animal welfare terms, which is of course where we're coming from, mm-hmm. we do have these concerns. The first one is really about the capacity for humane keeping of chickens. I don't think some people realize that it does require quite a high degree of knowledge and expertise in poultry husbandry to properly feed and care for poultry and to properly house them. Now, we're aware from looking at all the websites and discussions and articles that have appeared on this trend that there are people who take the trouble to get the proper resources, get the knowledge, acquire the expertise, and provide a few hens in the backyard with a very good home, which of course would be far superior to what you would see on any sort of factory farm. However, we feel that this is likely to follow the same sort of pattern that we've seen before with other animals. If you take, for example, the fad for exotic animals, what you normally see is a few dedicated enthusiasts who will invest in the proper equipment, who will do all the reading, acquire all the knowledge and expertise, and do a reasonable job of providing an appropriate an environment, or at least an attempt at an appropriate environment for their animals. But what normally happens after that is that once the fad spreads and more people come into it, you'll see a large number of people who don't take it as seriously as they should, don't take the responsibility as seriously as they should, acquire animals without the knowledge, without the resources, and simply don't provide the appropriate care, and this inevitably leads to animal suffering. And I have to say that we, of course, see this even with the most common domestic animals, the cats and dogs, that even after, 10,000 years of domestication, even with the huge network of veterinary services, animal welfare services that apply to dogs and cats, we continuously receive calls from people who simply don't have the resources, the ability, or the temperament to provide good homes for these animals. That's why we see stories of abused animals, cats and dogs, almost every day of the week in the media. That's why we have shelters full of homeless dogs and cats. So with those experiences, I'm afraid our worry with this trend towards urban poultry is that the same pattern will be followed, and that a number of enthusiastic people will do the right job, and they will be followed by a much larger number of people who won't provide humane care for chickens. Mm-hmm. So that's one our major concern. There are a number of others. One is another one is veterinary care. Most people today, if their dog or cat gets sick, some will have the ability to recognize symptoms straight away, and they will invariably take the animal to a veterinarian. And we're asking the question, is that going to happen with people who have a number of chickens? Are they going to be able to spot the signs of disease that may be present in poultry, and will they rush them off to a vet and pay the kinds of fees that a veterinary would charge today for treating poultry?
I've read just recently in the last Wednesday's Courier that there is no vet in the city who treats chickens.
That's exactly right. That's another question: is there the veterinary expertise available in these urban areas? And it appears there may not be in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. That's one problem. Another is, what about slaughter? As you said, when the chickens have finished laying, will people who have bought them for the production of eggs want to keep them on? Or are they going to keep spent hens as pets? And if they become old or ill, are they going to provide for humane slaughter? Again, with domestic animals like cats and dogs, most people will do the responsible thing and take the animal to the vet for euthanasia, a humane mm-hmm. death. Mm-hmm. Are people going to bother paying the fees or taking the trouble to ensure that poultry are humanely slaughtered? if they're going to slaughter them themselves, do they have the expertise and the willingness to do it the old-fashioned way and basically chop a chicken's head off? And are their neighbors and their neighbors' children going to be pleased with seeing that kind of thing taking place in their neighborhood? These are the kinds of things that that people need to think about before they take on the responsibility of caring for a number of animals. Another question is urban predators. We know that the Metro Vancouver area is home to predators such as raccoons and coyotes, and any poultry housing would need to be predator-proof. And again, that requires an investment, a knowledge, and the resources to provide that kind of housing. So these are the kinds of problems that we're concerned about.
Right, and chickens have to be looked after every day, don't they? You can't just leave them around to peck in the garden, I don't suppose.
It does require constant attention and care, as the same for any other animal. I mean, I hate to say this, but, we get calls from people saying, my boyfriend has left and he can't take his dog and he's left me with it, and I'm not interested. Can you find a home for this dog? Well, that kind of thing is going to happen when people take on poultry, where we're going to get calls from people who say, I've been left with half a dozen chickens. I'm not interested in them. Where do I take them?
Yes.
So, for us, and this is really, if this trend catches on and becomes widespread and popular, mm-hmm. we can foresee just yet another animal welfare problem emerging that we and the SPCA and other animal welfare agencies are going to have to deal with. And I have to say that, as you may have seen in the Courier article, the SPCA, the BC SPCA, shares our concerns.
Yes, I read that. General health is also a concern that you mentioned. And just this morning I heard about avian flu in Abbotsford and a quarantine that's gone on in a 3-kilometer radius around one of the farms. Now, that in the city, that could be a really serious thing, couldn't it?
Well, in our view, as you may remember from previous discussions we've had on this issue, that mm-hmm. avian flu is really a problem born of factory farming. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, though, if it emerges from factory farming and spreads as it did in the 2004 outbreak, you'll remember that a lot of people who had backyard flocks, who had exotic birds, pet birds and so on, who were in those affected areas, were forced to hand over their birds to the CFIA for euthanasia.
Right.
And there would be a potential problem if there were a serious outbreak that spread, across the Metro Vancouver area that could affect backyard poultry. We just don't know. But certainly, mm-hmm. That's an issue that I'm assuming that the
And it could CSIA jump to the humans. It could jump to humans, couldn't it? Because that's what we've been finding out with various diseases, like mad cow disease, for instance.
Yes, I mean, that's the kind of nightmare scenario that's been talked about but hasn't really happened here yet.
Yeah, yeah. So that so the Vancouver Humane Society is negative on the whole idea of having poultry in the city. But I was quite surprised how many local municipalities actually do allow chickens. For example, Burnaby, New Westminster, Richmond, and Surrey. And now, I guess you would say these are all a little bit further out than the heart of Vancouver. But I was a little bit surprised about that.
I mean, that's absolutely true. And although some of those areas may have been a little more traditionally rural than Vancouver, and some of them may mm-hmm. have larger properties and so on, our view on that, and I should add that it's not just those areas, but we're aware that Victoria and some American cities, including New York, have allowed this. And I suppose people will be saying, well, if it's okay in New York, why shouldn't it be okay in Vancouver? Our view on that is that this trend is only just beginning. There are a lot of benefits, and people are very excited about it on the environmental side of things. But our worry is that given time, if this becomes more widespread, that those cities, Victoria, New York, Portland, wherever you look, may find that a couple of years down the road there will be animal welfare problems. And our bottom line on this...
I'm sorry, Peter, I just want to interrupt a moment.
Sure.
How long have these cities, do you have any idea, like Victoria, has it, this been going on for some time, or is it a new renovation?
I'm really not sure
no.
in each case.
Okay.
Some have been rescinded or relaxed because people have been pushing for these changes as a result of this trend taking place. Others may have been just left on the books and not changed going back to the, you know, to many years ago.
Yes, I remember many years ago that we had a couple of chickens in our backyard when I was just a child, you know, I don't know, elementary school, I suppose. And the neighbors as well had chickens, and
yeah.
nobody seemed to mind. But and also, there are chickens, we know, in backyards today, but they're kind of undercover.
That's true. And to be honest, you know, mm-hmm. if it were kept to a handful of people who knew what they were doing, we wouldn't be so concerned. But mm-hmm. we think this is going to become popular, and that if these bylaws are rescinded or relaxed, that there could be some serious problems for the chickens. And I have to say that what we're asking people who are so enthusiastic about this idea should think about is perhaps think about the chickens, because everyone's got very excited about the benefits of these eggs, about the environmental benefits, about the food security benefits, mm-hmm. but we would ask people to think about the animal welfare issue, which in our experience seems to be always the last thing to be considered. As I was saying, our bottom line on this is that in our experience, whenever humans put animals to use, even, you know, with very benign intentions, it's always the animals who lose, and we're concerned that that's going to happen in this case as well.
Right. Is there any way of putting the animals high on their priority? For example, if it's unavoidable that this bylaw be amended, could there be stipulations in there that would put the animals high on the list of the requirements?
Yes, I think, if this bylaw change does go through, at the very least, we would hope that it is drafted with a number of significant conditions and restrictions, and the SPCA has put forward a number of these that would at least attempt to ensure that people keep these animals to a high standard, and that they are audited and inspected either by the city or some other party appointed to do so, to ensure that the animal welfare standards are kept very high.
Yeah, and perhaps it would be necessary to issue some sort of certificate or something to a person before he's allowed to put chickens in his backyard.
That would certainly be a step forward. As you're aware from our own Chicken Out campaign, in terms of commercial poultry, we suggest that if people are going to eat eggs, they should only buy them if they're certified organic or BCSBCA certified. Now, if people start producing eggs for themselves, they won't be subject to any certification like that, which at least allows third-party auditing for welfare standards. If there's nothing, no system like that put in place for backyard flocks in urban areas, then who knows how people are going to treat these animals.
Absolutely. So it's a dicey situation, isn't it? I mean, there's good in it, but there's also this terrible possibility that the chickens could be no better off than they are in factory farms today.
Yes, it's a very complex issue.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Peter, for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marge.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And Marge, you have something to say?
May I just get in one sentence? You have been listening to an interview with Peter Fricker, Project Coordinator of the Vancouver Humane Society.
And I wish to tell you that Peter Fricker was on this program exactly to this week in 2005. Thank you, Peter Fricker, for always being available on Animal Voices. Well, our webpage is animalvoices.org, and many of our programs will be posted. So we're going to go over to Alan and maybe a little bit of music.
That's John Reichman. That music reminds me of chickens running around somehow.
Yes, and shortly we're going to be doing an article about feeding the birds. We're going to talk about Bruce Passmore wrote a wonderful article. He says, do it right. And then just to comment on some of the articles that have been in the press in the last 2 weeks, that yesterday or the day before yesterday I saw an article in The Province, and that a cow was on the loose. Had managed to escape from an Abbotsford auction house. I mean, it's incredible with all the security and everything. So they've been trying to catch this cow, and always when they get close to it, it manages to escape them. And to this time, the cow is still surviving, hopefully managing to find something to eat. And I found this little caption about animals that escapes, especially cows. When a cow escapes her slaughterhouse fate, witnesses cheer the animal and boo her pursuers. It is human nature to root for the underdog or under cow whose death has been spared by an incredibly innate will to be free. So, will to be free, and of course, just a short note here about what's happening to, because that cow was had been transported. There was an article that was published in the Vancouver Sun subsequent to Jeff Urton's article. He's the animal welfare coordinator for the BCSPCA, and he commented on the animal transportation of chickens. And so, Trish McMurray from Burnaby, she wrote in this published article, she said, we need to rethink treatment of farm animals. And she was referring to the incredible number of animals that die on a trip to the slaughterhouse. And that was also mentioned in Jeff Urton's article. And she writes, she says, this is an issue far too often kept behind the walls of the transit vehicles and abattoirs, and one that seriously needs to be exposed, addressed, and dealt with. She writes, it's hard to believe that in this day and age, 13 million animals are found dead in the trucks or declared unfit for human consumption on arrival at their destination. And she writes, I applaud Jeff Urton of the BCSPCA for attempting to help our laws become more like Europe's governing the treatment of farm animals during transport. And then she says, why have we not progressed in our management of the animals we consume? I see I made the right move when I chose to boycott this industry 25 years ago. So much from Trish McMurray. I didn't ask her permission to read it, but I'm sure she won't mind. Well, in this time when it's cold and freezing outside, especially today here in Vancouver, what is the aspect here of feeding the birds? And the Vancouver Humane Society spokesperson, Bruce Passmore, he wrote very eloquently about that, and we'll cover that. But Alan Jensen is really a bird person too. Alan, what should we be feeding animals, these birds, and how do we do it right?
I think there's no problem as long as you think about what you're doing and pay attention to what you're feeding the birds, the stuff you're giving them, the food you're giving them, and the fact that once you start, you can't stop. Birds become dependent on sources of food. They're very smart, and they quickly learn where their food is, but they develop habits. And if you have a bird feeder or just put birds outside your door, food outside your door for the birds for a few days, for a couple of weeks, then the birds will start to get used to it, and they will start to depend on it. And then if you stop putting it out, especially like when the weather turns and the birds need more food, they need more energy to keep warm, That can be a serious problem. So you have to make a commitment. If you're going to start feeding the birds and putting up a bird feeder in the winter especially, it's different in the summer because there's loads of food around anyway, and so it's not going to interfere with things too much. But in the winter, it's very important to keep that in mind, that you have to keep it up and keep the supply of food up throughout the winter if you're going to do that.
Now, Alan, you mentioned the quality of food that people putting out there. So some of these shrubs we can grow, which are indigenous, they provide feed all year round to these to the birds. Can you mention a few of them?
I'm not the person to say exactly what crops you should grow to provide seeds and food for the birds all year round. The indigenous plants are a very good thing. If you've got a garden, it's a very good idea to go to a plant shop and buy indigenous plants. Most good plant stores have a supply of them.
Now,
if you're growing indigenous plants, then those are the plants that the local birds are going to be used to.
Now, I know that even when the blackberries have dried out and they're still attached to the shrub, the birds will feed on them.
Blackberries are not our friend. You know, they're an exotic plant. They're not a local plant. They're an exotic plant. And they tend, first of all, to take over country. And you see huge patches of blackberries. That's because they've pushed out all the local indigenous plants and because they have no natural enemy. Same as English ivy. It's terrible. Like in Stanley Park, they're always working all the time to try and remove the ivy because it just spreads over. It'll strangle the trees, but also it'll push out the local plants, and there's no room for the local plants to grow. So you're right, blackberries do provide food for the birds. When the berries are ripe, there's fresh fruit, but throughout the winter there is some dried fruit for the birds. But you have to keep in mind that that the blackberries are displacing the indigenous plants.
Now, I'll redeem myself, Alan, by saying hawthorn as well, because I believe that's indigenous. But I've noticed that the birds love the holly tree, and especially that's not all that indigenous either. But holly, they do, and arbutus.
Yeah, arbutus is indigenous, and same as the ash, mountain ash, that has red berries like the holly tree does, and that's a local plant, and the birds love the mountain ash.
Now the arbutus seeds, they sort of almost ferment at the time Christmas and New Year celebrations are around. So they also get a little bit of that alcoholic sweetness.
And, little holiday cheer, right?
And if they have these seeds, they can celebrate with us that Yuletide. Margie, you have a question?
Now, I have an indigenous garden out in the front of my house, and one thing I put in for the birds was snowberry.
Oh, good. Great. Yeah.
But I haven't seen a bird on that bush in 5 years.
I'm not sure that snowberry, in some parts of the country, you would be attracting birds. I'm not sure around here it would work. Anyway, we only have about 30 seconds.
We're
almost out of time. Mm.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yep.
And we've had a great program today. Thank you for listening. And in this program, Animal Voices, yes, we do envision a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom. And in this program, we celebrate the glory of the animal kingdom.